Today is the 19th of November, 2022. Time keeps passing. The year is almost over. And something people ask about sometimes is, how do you keep going in the Dhamma practice? So I thought I would talk a little bit about perseverance, because we start out, we might feel inspired to visit the monastery, feel inspired to practice, and then that inspiration only lasts for so long, and then it passes away at a certain point. It has to pass away, and then we might feel disheartened or like we're not quite sure what we're doing. And so that's where this quality of perseverance comes into play. And we can only use other qualities like patient endurance. We can only kind of force our way forward for so long. We might feel like, okay, well, it doesn't matter what happens. I'll force my way forward. I'll just keep kind of doggedly bowling my way forward. But without this quality of perseverance, then eventually we'll crash, eventually we'll kind of cave in. So how do we cultivate this quality of perseverance? So I think it's connected with adhitana. So one of these paramis, there's the 10 paramitas we talk about. So this adhitana parami, and that's the perfection or the quality of, the spiritual quality of determination. And when we follow through with things, that's the definition that I find helpful for adhitana. Is the ability to follow through with things. So we start something and then we see it to completion. We follow through. So we start a practice, we see it to completion, we start a project, we see it to completion. We don't just leave a lot of loose ends. We don't, if we're only starting things but not seeing them through to completion, that means we're interested only in the beginnings, but we don't really see the endings. So there is excitement in beginnings, but then there's a period of something is sustained, and then there's a time when it ends. So adhitana is seeing something through to completion. So when I think back for myself, becoming an Anagarika back in 2001, and that was exciting. It was a beginning, a new beginning. I wanted to make a fresh start, a new start, and so coming to Abhayagiri, becoming an Anagarika, and it was exciting. There were these different practices happening. They were meditating all night on the Wan Pra, lunar observance, and it was very inspiring, and I was trying hard to meditate and to get results quickly, and so that was exciting. And I remember one of the first Dhamma talks I heard. At first, I came here actually backing up even before I became an Anagarika. I came here in May of 2001, stayed as a guest for a week, and then the first Dhamma talk I heard here was Ajahn Amaro. Or no, sorry, it was actually Longpo Pasano was here when I first came for 1 week. And then when I came back in June, it was only Ajahn Amaro here, and Ajahn Pasano was away visiting his mother in Canada, I believe. And then that's when I heard Ajahn Amaro give the first Saturday night talk that I heard when I came here to stay long term. And I was feeling very inspired. And I remember Ajahn Amaro talking about how the Buddha's parinibbana, and the Buddha's about to pass away, and he's surrounded by all of his disciples, and there is like heavenly flowers raining down upon him, and there's celestial music playing, and the Buddha kind of telling his disciples, yeah, do you see all this? What kind of honor and homage is paid to the Tathagata? And they say, yes, Lord, we see it. This is wonderful. This is marvelous. This is amazing. And then he says, well, if you really want to pay me homage, don't shower me with flowers and with music, but practice the Noble Eightfold Path and see it through to completion. That way you do true homage to the Tathagata. And so that was, I remember that was the first talk I heard Ajahn Amaro give, and I found that very inspiring. So I thought, okay, there's this idea, there's something to this, this seeing it through to completion. So then, of course, time goes on and we forget it. Those things are easy to forget. The mind quickly changes. So after being in Anagarika then for 8 months, I remember I suddenly got this one day, I was just, no, I think I'm going to leave. I think that's the right decision. So I went to tell Ajahn Amaro, I've decided I'm going to leave. And so he said, okay, let's talk tomorrow. So I had a hard time sleeping that night, mind going back and forth, thinking, okay, what should I do? Stay, should I go? And then by the morning time, I pretty much decided I was going to stay. So then I went to see Ajahn Amaro, and he said, how many times did you change your mind last night? And I said, oh, it's too many to count. But I decided I'm going to stay. So the mind quickly changes, and it can seem very, very compelling and very convincing. So when we feel sure about something, when we feel sure about something, it can seem very real. And so we make these things real. I have to leave. I just have a bad feeling about this. And so this can seem very real. But then I didn't leave, I stayed. I remember it was so real that I wrote a letter thanking the Ajahns for helping me out. And I walked around the loop trail saying goodbye to the land. And then I remember, then that night the mind changed again. So that's how it goes. And then becoming a novice, that was another new beginning, and still feeling like, okay, very inspired and wanting to move forward with things and becoming a bhikkhu. And then after about a month of being a bhikkhu, it was kind of like, oh no, I'm in this for the long haul. And now it's just drudgery. Nothing to look forward to now. It's just, there was all this excitement. Yeah, becoming an Anagarika, becoming a novice, becoming a bhikkhu, and now drudgery. Just nothing to look forward to. Okay, well maybe for my third Vasa, you get to go away for a year. I can look forward to that. But at the beginning, that just seemed like a long way off. So this tends to happen for new bhikkhus. So we've got three new bhikkhus coming up on December 4th, if anybody didn't know. So just to say, oh yeah, as a new bhikkhu, the second year as a bhikkhu is usually pretty difficult. So second year as a bhikkhu, it's kind of like that, what we call the honeymoon phase wears off. And then it's just, I remember Lumpur Pasano talking about this. He said, after going to Wat Pho Phong, feeling really inspired and giving himself to Lumpur Cha, and then a year goes by or so, and then he's sitting in his kuti cursing the Buddha, because he has this way of hooking us and inspiring us, and then we get down to doing the work, and then we realize, oh, this is a lot of work, this work of training the mind. And so then we need that adhitana, we need to persevere in the practice. And it's so easy to always look to external things and try to make excuses as to why it's too difficult, or make excuses as to why we shouldn't persevere. So there'll always be 1,000 reasons why evidence as to why we have our current mental state. But if we take charge of our own heart and we actually take responsibility for our own actions of body, speech, and mind, then that's incredibly empowering, and then that's when we can persevere. If we're always bemoaning external circumstances, the society's like this, the society's like that, it's unjust, it's not fair, and that we can't really do much about it, so we can feel disempowered when we pin our feelings, when we pin our feelings on outside circumstances, then there's not much we can do about it. But if we look at the causes and conditions in our own mind, this is what we chanted this evening, the Four Noble Truths. This is what the Buddha's pointing to with the Four Noble Truths, is that in our own mind, we can actually do something about this. All things converge on feeling. So feeling is one of Longpo Liam's favorite words in Thai. It's Kwam Rusuk. And that he says it all the time, because everything is feeling. So that's all it is. We're just experiencing feeling. And then we make it more than that, make a story out of it. So coming back to, it's just feeling. And there's pleasant feeling, there's painful feeling, and there's neither pleasant nor painful feeling. There are those three types of feeling. And then pleasant feeling, the mind reacts in a default, has a default reaction to that. That default reaction is wanting more. Unpleasant feeling, default reaction is wanting to get rid of it. Neither pleasant nor painful feeling can be a couple different default reactions. That would be either being deluded by it, bewildered by it, or unexcited by it and wanting more pleasant or painful feeling because it's more exciting. Pleasant feeling has the another default verbal reaction of praise. We'll tend to praise when we're experiencing pleasant feeling. When we're experiencing painful feeling, we'll tend to criticize. So it's that easy, it's that simple. But it's difficult to see this. It's habitual to look outside of ourselves. So So with the Four Noble Truths, we see that there is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There's the end of suffering. There's a path leading to the ending of suffering. So there is suffering. There is dukkha. Just acknowledging when there is dukkha in our mind, that's the first step. It's not denying it or repressing it or trying to get away from it, but it's just noticing there is dukkha. One possible translation of dukkha is not quite rightness. So things just aren't quite right. Things are unsettled. And then the Buddha talks about the cause of dukkha. The Buddha talks about the cause of dukkha as tanha, as craving. that we're discontent because of this craving, craving for sense pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for annihilation, these three types of craving. So normally what our mind is teaching us, what our mind is telling us is the cause of dukkha was, the cause of dukkha is this person that said that to me. That's the cause of dukkha. The cause of dukkha is this political situation. The cause of dukkha is this illness. The cause of dukkha is the person eating too loud next to me. That's the cause of dukkha. So that's what our mind is teaching us and telling us. It's totally normal. If your mind is doing this, it's totally normal and you're not different from everybody else. The cause of dukkha is it's too hot. The cause of dukkha is it's too cold. The cause of dukkha is there wasn't salad dressing on the table. Actually, there was today, but so there was happiness, at least a little bit. The cause of dukkha is that there's too much rain. The cause of dukkha is there's too much fire. And then eventually when we look to all those causes of dukkha, and then we say, oh wait, what did the Buddha say? What did the Buddha say the cause of dukkha was? It wasn't this other person. It wasn't this situation. It was craving. It was me not wanting things to be as they are in this moment. So, and then the Buddha says, if you address that, you can actually do something about that. You can't do something about all those external things, or you can do very little. You might exhaust yourself trying to change external conditions, but you can actually look inward and change your own mind, train your own mind. But it takes time, it takes work. So it takes perseverance to see these things and address these things. So then we start to get it, and we start to see, oh yeah, okay, there is this craving, I can see it there, it's there. And then there's a period where, a very long period of many years, where we see the craving, but we can't yet let go of it, we can't yet relinquish it. So the Buddha said to get to that cessation of dukkha, it comes through the complete relinquishment and abandonment of that craving. And that takes courage, it takes faith, it takes adhitana, it takes determination, because that's all it is. It's that complete relinquishment, complete release from it. I remember I used to do this as a novice. I would be doing walking meditation on the lunar observance day and bring myself to grief because I couldn't let go of craving, and just telling myself, just let go. Why can't you just let go? This is, you know, it's stupid. You could just, you know, you have to let go of it. Just let go. And then the mind still not being able to let go. So we can't do it quickly. It's not just by an act of will. We can't do this just by an act of will, just by telling ourselves to let go. If it was that easy, then none of us would really have to even come to the monastery. So it's not about just telling yourself to let go, because letting go only comes from wisdom. And so it ends up being that the whole Noble Eightfold Path, the path to the cessation of the craving, that we have to focus on. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, and so on. And having to actually cultivate the path and in my opinion, it's the only way. Sila Samadhi Panya. Sila Samadhi Panya, the virtue, meditation, and wisdom, discernment, is a summary of the Noble Eightfold Path. So sila is the virtue, which is the intentions, the right intention, the right speech, right action, right livelihood. it might just, actually right intention might be under samadhi. Yeah, samadhi is the right intention, right mindfulness, right concentration, panya, right view. So sila samadhi panya is a summary of the path. It's an easy way to remember it. So to keep precepts long term, that takes perseverance, that takes determination. One of the blessings of ordaining, one of the blessings of being in a monastery is that through the ebb and flow and the ups and downs of our lives, we're actually able to keep these precepts, and that steps it up for us. Whereas, say, before I came to the monastery, if I could keep precepts for a little while, but then the moment my feelings were strong and I just didn't want to keep the precepts, then I didn't have to. I wasn't in a group that was keeping precepts, so it was difficult. I knew I had to actually have a teacher and be in a group of like-minded people who were doing the same thing. So it's difficult. Keeping precepts is difficult. And the Buddha's telling us we have to do what's difficult to do. We have to endure what's difficult to endure. It's difficult because it entails doing things which are unpleasant, but ultimately are of great benefit to us. Things like just restraint, or just restraining our speech when we want to say something unskillful. That's incredibly beneficial. It's incredibly beneficial for us because we don't burn ourselves with wrong speech, and then it's incredibly beneficial for others. We don't harm others with our speech. One pitfall is that we can become hopelessly idealistic. So if we come to the practice and we feel like we're coming from the world, we come to the monastery, what are these monks doing? They're not practicing correctly. So they might not. I also experienced this. The monks didn't meet my ideal of what a monk should be. People should all be sleeping 4 hours a night. It's in the suttas. So that's, not everyone here is sleeping just 4 hours a night. That's uninspiring. I'm uninspired by that. It's wrong. And everybody should be sleeping 4 hours a night. And everybody should be stricter. Nobody should be talking. People here talk too much. Nobody should be talking or joking around. I had these ideas when I first came here. Then I tried sleeping 4 hours a night, and I think I could sustain it for one night, maybe two nights. So there's the ideal, and then there's the reality of the human condition, which is messy. We like ideals because they're clean and neat and they're tidy, but it's not the way the human heart is. It's not the way the body and the mind is. The body and the mind is messy. So we have this mess that we have to gain insight into. And the mind is making a mess. So because the mind is making a mess, we have to start seeing what's the mess maker, where is the mess maker in the mind. And if we can deal with the mess maker, which is delusion, then we won't have to go around picking up the mess all the time. We'll finally be able to rest, and just we'll be able to be at ease, finally. Longpo Cha said, all these years of practice just so we can be at ease. All these years of hard practice just so we can be happy. But it's so worth it, because otherwise, where is happiness? Yeah. So as time passes, we do have to keep persevering, and we have to know, we have to caution ourselves all the time that the mind changes quickly. And sometimes we might think, what am I even doing here? I actually don't even know what I'm doing. I've been here for 10 years, 20 years. What am I doing? It doesn't make any sense. So the mind can do that as well. So, but then when we meditate, and then that one day when we feel peaceful, then we remember, oh yeah, that's why I'm practicing, that's why I'm here. That one day that we gain insight, we remember, oh yeah, that's what we're doing. So things do click eventually. That one success where we're able to actually let go of something, or we're actually able to catch ourselves and not say the unskillful thing we wanted to say. So then we realize that's what it's for. Then we can persevere. So we need to encourage ourselves. We can't really wait for encouragement to come from outside, because our mind is what's teaching us all the time. So we need to, our mind has to teach us, encourage us, you know, coax us forward, give us some instruction, give us some encouragement. Goodwill, metta, that's also very important in order to temper the practice. So when it's difficult to move forward, then we need goodwill all the time. We need metta all the time. It's a very wholesome mental state, which gives us energy, gives us the power to keep moving forward. So even if the body might be tired, then with goodwill, then the mind is bright, even though the body is tired. And that also gives us the courage to move forward. So I'm only thinking to give a pretty short talk this evening, so I'll leave it there.